We've all had a little break, and we're going to go back to yourself now, Advocate, and to move on now. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. The next clause, Clause 11, this deals with Section 85 of the Act, which is for the court to declare and relieve over-indebtedness. What we provide for here is simply that the court must inquire whether a consumer, a court has something before the court that shows the consumer is over-indebted, and there must be some orders made to assist the consumer. But while the court is considering this, the court must also or may also look at whether this consumer perhaps could qualify for debt intervention. We have this in draft 5, but it was pointed out to us that you can't force the consumer to participate in debt intervention. So what we've only amended here is to say that the court must inquire if the consumer wishes to participate, and then the court can either refer the matter to the National Credit Regulator, or if the court has sufficient information before it, can make the relevant order. So that is what that clause deals with. The next clause is Section 86 of the Principal Act, which deals with your application for debt review. What we have here is mostly paragraph B that is the important one. The first paragraph there is simply to say that debt counsellors must always look to see whether an agreement is reckless, not just on the request. Paragraph B, the highlighted part, is we had a concern from the regulator that when a debt review application is before a court, the courts have said that they cannot reduce the interest rate. Now, we have that discussion in the previous meeting. My interpretation of the Act says that they can, and I think a number of members looking at the Act said, but it must be, surely you must be able to reduce the interest rate. But it seems that there are some courts who interpret it otherwise. Now, what I've initially done is to provide for the tribunal to be able to reduce it specifically, but then the committee said, no, we also want the courts to be able to reduce. This is one of the other things that will have to be advertised. So this is something new. So this will have to be advertised.
Can you give us the number again?
It is clause 12, paragraph B, which inserts sub-paragraph CC, capital A. So, and I've inserted it here because this now means that it applies to both the court and the tribunal. So I don't have to put it where we initially had it in section 87. It is now inserted here to say that and of course, because it reads the court, it says the court may determine the maximum interest, fees, or other charges, which maximum may be zero, for such a period as the court deems fair and reasonable. Although I use the word court, that is simply because I'm inserting it into section 86. When we get to section 87, you'll see that I say that this section applies with the necessary changes, which means that it then applies to the tribunal. So that is what I'm doing there. It was one of the things flagged, and this is how I resolved it. I don't know if members maybe want to comment on that, but that is what I've done there. Thank you, Chief. The next clause 13, then deals with the application for debt intervention. So what this does is it actually just takes the debt review process and it puts it within the National Credit Regulator in respect of certain consumers. So, and there's not much that changes here. It's the same as the fifth draft. So I'll maybe just go through this quite fast. In subsection 1, the flag issue there is again the issue of the 50,000 being that can be adjusted, but we'll look at that when we get to the regulations clause. Second subsection deals with the agreements that don't form part. It's nothing new. The regulator must comply with, and I specifically refer back to section 86 so that we tie it in with the debt review process. 86 deals with the debt review process. So when the National Credit Regulator gets the application, they must notify the credit provider, the credit bureaus, and so on. And, of course, the debt intervention applicant and the credit provider must participate in this and provide whatever information they need. Then we say, subsection 5 on the next page, page 14, I think that's an important one. The regulator must, when they consider this application, provide the debt intervention applicant with counseling on financial literacy and capability and access to training to improve that debt intervention, Africans' financial literacy and capability. Then subsection 6, this simply repeats again 86 regarding what can be done. Reject the application, or you don't qualify, but I can see there's a problem, we can do a voluntary rearrangement, or see if there's reckless lending, unlawful credit agreement, do the necessary referral to the tribunal. D and E are the two important ones. So D is the actual referral for rearrangement, and E is the referral for suspension. And the only difference is, can you solve within a period of 5 years? So that is the period. Or, and I've provided, if there is a longer period that may be prescribed. So that is what that clause deals with there. Subsection 7, 8, and 9 and 10, I apologize, I see there is a, I just want to make a note for myself, I see there is a, H15, I've got an incorrect subsection there. There is no 9. I'm just going to correct it. Oh, I see it there. There's a 9. It seems that it is just a bit in there. Okay, I see it now. So all of that is simply copying from section 86. It is 100% copying from section 86, which deals with debt review. So all of these processes that are in place in respect of debt review are in place in respect of the debt intervention. Subsection 12, however, is the more important one. Now, the highlighted portion there is when we look at the suspension and the extinguishing, that's the shorter period measure. So the 7,500 and the 50,000 must not change in respect of that period. I'm now on page 16, subsection 12, it's highlighted and in blue font.
One moment. Honourable Esterhazen, you've just joined us. We got your apology, your late apology. We're on the document you're going to be given now, page 16. And if you would also sign the register. Thank you, Advocate.
Thank you, Chair. So what this subsection simply does, this first paragraph, is to say that in respect of the suspension or the extinguishing of debts, the debt intervention applicant can only have a maximum income of 7,500 and the total unsecured debt can only be 50,000. That cannot change. So that is what that provides. Then this is our sunset clause. So what we're saying is this possible referral for the suspension or the extinguishing is only effective for a period of 48 months. It was 24, we've extended it to 48, to just make sure that there is enough data for the minister to actually be able to do an impact review, which is in paragraph C. That's an impact, and if it is necessary to extend, the minister can extend after the minister consulted with the assembly. The next clause, clause 14, is section 87, and this deals with the actual rearrangement of the consumer's obligations. So all I'm doing here is we're inserting a specific clause repeating what is already in 87, but in relation to the tribunal. So we simply say the tribunal may rearrange a person's debt, and then there what I talk on page C17, subsection 1A, paragraph B, subparagraph 2 is where the tribunal is then can make that order regarding the interest rate being zero, etc. That is the reference and the blue there with the necessary changes. The next section, 87A,
I know that it is subsection 2, if you would just use the word Roman numeral for the more old-fashioned of us.
Thank you, Chair. The Roman numeral 2 there. What that refers to simply is the 86, section 86.7c, the subparagraph 2 of the Roman numeral 2 is the one that deals, that includes now the reduction of the interest to zero. So that is the reference there. If I then can move to the next clause, clause 15. Clause 15 inserts section 87A into the Act. This is the important one. This is the section that deals with suspension and with extinguishing. So what we have here, and it starts on page 18 there. First off, we retain the fact that a single member of the tribunal may consider this. Because remember, when we copy the debt review process, there's sufficient participation from the credit provider there. So there's no concern there. Then the tribunal in subsection 2 we say the tribunal has the discretion in to say, no, you don't qualify for it, or we are suspending your qualifying credit agreement. And when the tribunal does that, subparagraph 2, the Roman numerals 2, says the tribunal must require the debt intervention applicant to attend a financial literacy or financial capability program. So in other words, the B is if the tribunal makes the order in subsection 1, you'll see there's an and there. It means that he must. You can't suspend without the literacy being required. So we've put it in there. It was with extinguishing, but we brought it forward so it is with the suspension. Then subsection 3, this gives a number of factors that the tribunal must take into account. Members will recall that there was criticism against the tribunal not having discretion when it makes an order. So now I've listed everything I could think of regarding the applicant, the history of the applicant, as well as the credit provider, and both role that they played into getting where we are now. The blue in subsection 3, that is simply because of the change to the word total unsecured debts, where we said this is the principal amount only. I had to change it so that it is clear that what is suspended is also the interest and the charges, etc. Otherwise, it's only the principal debt that is suspended. Then, so all those factors goes over onto page 19. Then subsection 4, this simply says that when there is a suspension, section 84, which deals with how suspension works, it is the effect of suspension on a credit agreement. So no amount may be charged during that time, etc., etc. That will apply to this suspension as well. And then we make provision in paragraph B there for prescription. Members will recall there was a concern, what if during suspension my claim prescribes, but I can't institute any litigation, and let's say the suspension lapses because this person just doesn't go back or whatever, but now my claim as a credit provider has prescribed. So we have just made provision there that if there is prescription, it will only lapse at the end of the suspension. Subsection 5, so what we have is this process of the debt review. There is the suspension, then we have after 8 months of the suspension, the regulator must review the financial circumstances of the consumer. If the consumer, this is paragraph B, has sufficient income or assets, the recommendation from the regulator must be for a rearrangement of obligations. Roman numeral 2 there on page 20. If the consumer still does not have enough income or assets to solve, then it is referred to the tribunal for a further suspension. Paragraph C there, if the tribunal orders a further extension, the regulator must again, after 8 months, in that second period of suspension, review what the consumer can or can't pay. And then Roman numeral 1 under paragraph C, if the consumer at that stage, so this is in your second year of suspension, has enough money, maybe started having a salary, etc., then make a recommendation for the debt to be repaid, or if still cannot solve, then to refer to the tribunal for extinguishing of the debt. So what this process makes very clear is that the first step in any consideration is whether the consumer can pay. So that was one of the criticisms. You can't just extinguish. But what we're making clear now is the first step is always, can the consumer pay? That is very clear now. Then subsection, paragraph D there, just means that every time that the regulator makes a referral to the tribunal, they must inform the credit provider, and the credit provider can make some representations. Subsection 6, then that indicates that the tribunal can in fact, having considered a number of things, the referral, all the information received, whether there's not enough income or assets, the factors in subsection 3, in other words, the role of the credit provider, the role of the consumer, and we'll get to 7 and 8 now, they may declare the total cost of credit again, the same thing. It can't just be the capital, must be the total cost of credit. They can declare that extinguished. Subsection 7 simply says that it may just be a percentage of the debt, but then that must apply across the board to all credit agreements. So you can't favor one credit provider over another. Subsection 8 says that when the tribunal limits this applicant's right, when the tribunal gives this order, the tribunal must limit the applicant's right to apply for credit for a minimum period of, and then the discussion last time indicated to me 12 months for the compulsory period, but then the maximum period is in subsection 9 there. So there may also be a discretionary further period which may not exceed, and it seems that the discussion was on 24 months. This is where that map that was handed out to members comes in. So if we look at that map, you will see on the side of that page, the grey area, that indicates that is the period in which you cannot apply for credit. Now, members will see that if your discretionary order goes to a maximum of 60 months, there's about 7 years that a person cannot apply for credit. If it goes up to a maximum of 48 months, there's 6 years that a person can't apply for credit. So if, as we have it now, the 24 months, there's a four-year period where the person is taken out of the credit market. If the person can solve, that is actually a little bit longer, because during the period where you are repaying your debt, you can't apply for credit. So, but the thing is that with the extinguishing, the question is, this person is now given this relief. So how long should this person be given before they can go back into the market? So that is then where the discussion comes in about the current, what we are proposing, the 12 months compulsory, so there is a consequence. The fact that you get extinguishing is not just a free-for-all. 12 months you'll be taking out of the credit market after the extinguishing order, and then there can be a discretionary further period of 12 months for that consumer, for instance, who had maybe some bad hiccups. the compulsory 12 months would be, for instance, for a person who was retrenched and there was no fault of his own or so, but perhaps the discretionary period, taking it up to 24 months, is perhaps where the consumer maybe was not so honest when he or she applied for credit and so on. So I'll maybe just leave that there, because that is one of the discussions with the 12 and the 24 months that we need direction on.
Right. Do we understand exactly what direction is required here for the legal crafter, Honourable Williams?
Chippers, I think that we should go for the 12 months and not the 24 months. And then at the second one on clause 9, we should go for the 20...
Interrupt you a moment. When you say that, won't you give us a reason so we get an understanding?
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I think that we should go for the 12 months because it is quite a long period not to have access to credit, including the period where you had to not have access to credit while you were applying for the debt relief measure. So it is quite a long time. I mean, I think that 12 months is sufficient, because you must also bear in mind that just because you can access credit doesn't mean you are going to get any credit, because the credit providers will know that you're a beneficiary of the debt review mechanism, and you might not then further not be able to access credits, you know, just because of that consequence. So I think that we should give a reasonable period, and I think that reasonable period is 12 months after they've got the relief. Thank you.
From committee members. I think I want to be quite clear about this. You put it this way, Honourable Williams, that it was after they had received relief. 12 months after they had received relief. Huh? Right. At one point, I know we were considering, after our visit to to London, as it were, the UK, that they had a clause which indicated that
if you did need to get school shoes or something particularly urgent, that should be allowed even after, you know, during the period, as soon as you got the debt relief, you should still be able to go and buy the school shoes, for example. Do you remember that issue that came up? And those who perhaps were in London. Yes, and that, so you still say, no, let's keep it at 12 months. All right, then, I'm not here to... I just want people to be sure of what they're agreeing to. Honourable Khadebe, followed by the Honourable Williams.
Chairperson, when you take into consideration that immediately when the application is done, that person is out of the credit market. No, minimum is 24 months, if I'm not mistaken. So that person is totally out of the market. What effect would it have if you say that after this thing has been extinguished, and then that person qualifies after that, if he's gainfully employed?
You're putting a qualification there, if he's fully employed, you know, you're adding that as a qualifier, which is not here. I am going to come to you in a minute. I just want to hear Honourable Williams. Well, Honourable Williams, can we hear Honourable Esterhazen, and then you come in after that? Yes.
Chair, morning, and again, my apologies for coming late. Chair, I would agree with Honourable Williams that on 12 months, but the only concern I've got is if an applicant's financial circumstances doesn't really improve, the tribunal can declare the debt or extinguish it, and that would be a problem then. Then 24 months would maybe more something to look at. You know, because then we can create a precedent that everyone in 12 months your debt is extinguished. Thank you.
All right, Honourable Williams.
Thank you, Chairperson. I had actually, it had slipped my mind, the English experience that we gained. You see, the problem here is we're talking about after they've received relief, but during the process of receiving relief, which can take up to 4 years or so, they haven't accessed any credit there. Perhaps this figure should be less than 12 months, because it could be 6 months. But you must remember that when we inquired about the moral hazard that could have happened, and with experience with the United Kingdom, they said there was no moral hazard, and that there hadn't been a massive amount of reborrowing with the people that had, defaulting with the people that had reborrowed money. Also bearing in mind that we have the person who has received relief has been sent on a course or has had some sort of course about financial controls, their own finances. So I don't know, perhaps after that British experience, perhaps we should reduce that to a six-month period, not even a 12-month period, bearing in mind the whole process has already taken 4 years. So they've been out of the market, credit market, for a four-year period, and then we, after relief, we give them 6 months, and then they're back into as before. Thank you. Sorry, I didn't mean to change my position, but I have.
Well, no, that's the, you know, the benefit of having listened to colleagues. Mr. Kumkani.
Thank you, Chair. I just wanted to, on the issue that the committee is deliberating on, when we passed the National Credit Amendment Act in 2014, there were people who were in the credit bureaus for judgments. They would be in there for quite a number of times or a number of years, to the extent that we said if you have paid up that judgment, which in previously, even if you had paid it up, it would stay in the credit bureau for 5 years, even more, to the extent that you won't access credit, but you would have paid it off. We came with a provision to say, in the event of a paid-up judgment, within seven days, the credit bureaus must remove that information. I just wanted to advise the committee within the same line of reasoning to say, if you have been under a debt intervention process and it's actually done, how about having the same thing? Because I see it being challenged constitutionally, where it might seem to be discriminating in terms of access to credit to this group of people after having undergone the debt intervention process, and then they can't have access to credit because they have been there. Whereas for people in general, if they have paid up judgments of which they have, settled them, then they can access credit because they have actually been removed out of that bad credit record, to the extent that it would be then be a discretion of the credit provider whether or not to provide credit to those people. That's what I wanted to clarify to the committee. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think that was a timely intervention. Advocate van der Merwe, just on this issue.
Thank you, Chair. I hear what Mr. Mungani is saying, but we must just be careful. This is not a paid-up judgment. This is an extinguishing of a debt. And one of the criticisms that we received on Draft 5 is that there's no consequence for the consumer. Because in Draft 5, this suspension was 100% discretionary. There was no compulsory period of discretion. So we can reduce it to the 6 months, but I would advise that there should be some compulsory period. The discretionary period where there's like a maximum then perhaps of 24 months, because that will look into the actual circumstances of each person. And it's for the tribunal then to say, well, 12 months maximum or 7 months maximum or whatever. But I would caution, the criticism was that there was no consequence. So we need to show some consequence for an extinguishing of a debt.
No, thank you very much for that clarification, Honourable Williams.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, again, I go back to the 6 months that I've proposed. The reason is because the process takes so long that the individual is writing off 50,000 rands over a period of 4 years or so. They can't access any credit whatsoever during that time. And then they've been told, everybody who does provide credit has been told about this individual. Let's say they're called Mr. Williams. So Mr. Williams won't have access to credit for 4 years during the process. His 50,000 rand is written off. Everybody knows that he's gone through this process, so when he applies for more debt credit, perhaps that is going to play against him. I think that it should be a six-month period so that, because hopefully we're trying to also educate the people so that they don't make these mistakes again and get over-indebted. But it's a very difficult decision to make on this, because we don't know how the population or the over-indebted population are going to respond to this. But I, like I said, we gave the private sector the benefit of the doubt previously. I think we should give the South African people the benefit of the doubt now and make this period a six-month period. Thank you.
Right. Yes, thank you very much, Honourable Khadebe.
Chairperson, I understand what the advocate is saying, but I think that Honourable Williams is correct that during the intervention period, the person cannot get any debt during that time. But what is very important, when coming to extinguishing, it comes with the issue of training. It means that when that term comes to an end, that person, when the extinguishing happens, that person will have been trained. So the issue of Mr. Kumkani now holds water, because this person will have been trained, has been gone through years without any credit. Why not use the 7 days then? Why not use the 7 days that after that, and then let it be the 7 days notice?
I just want to remind members of a caution we were given on the constitutional aspect here, on the legal side, that when we do these, the question that is raised there is, you know, is this reasonable? Is it X? Is it Y? Otherwise, it amounts almost to, well, there's nothing here, even though there were 4 years in the past. But now, what are 7 days? And you let loose, in inverted commas. So, at one point in our discussions, we were saying, Honourable Khadebe, you know, at one point in our discussion, we were saying, look, we don't want the setback to the Constitutional Court. We want to avoid that. So the issue is to put criteria there in place whenever we do what to us is not a huge write-off to banks, etc., but We have seen that whenever we do attempt to write anything off with the general public, the mainstream does take offense, as it were. It would find itself back in the Constitutional Court, you see. Now, we do want to avoid that with this, because that would hold up the implementation. So, I'm not telling you what to do, but what I am advising is that you just remember what we were told about that. So if your viewers know, well, look, let's stick to 6 months and not go to the 7.5 days, although I seem to hear from yourself now, Advocate Vandermeer, that they may say, well, why can't it be 7.5 if it applied to something else? Could you just refresh our memories there?
The 7 days that Mr. Kumkani was referring to is where there was a judgment debt against the consumer, and the consumer actually paid that off. So in other words, the consumer would have gone through a process where they've repaid that money, and that is where the 7 days comes in. What we have here is that there is an extinguishing of the debt. So because that is such a, this is the first time that we have something like this where a debt is extinguished. And the criticism was that you have this consequence for the credit provider. The debt is gone. That money no longer can come to the credit provider, but there's no consequence for the consumer. So yes, there is this 4-year period, but once the extinguishing is actually done, then there is no further consequence. So it is just to balance that, and that's why I'm saying we can perhaps reduce the period to a 6 months compulsory, and then something discretionary, and that can take a person's role into account.
I just wanted to say before two colleagues come in, when I was in China, I just remember the Minister of Finance writing, "New millions."
To encourage people to pay taxes. Wasn't called extinguishing, of course. But anyway, let's move on. Honourable McLawball, followed by, you can come in as well, Honourable Kachalia, and Honourable Khadebe.
No, thanks. I think we're laughing with the comrade Khadebe, extinguishing and looking just thousands of fires. there has to be a cooling off period, so that at least it becomes a deterrent of some of the actions we take, because you don't want people who actually give credit at the very same time we expose them to too much risk.
Yeah.
But at the very same time, we don't want to be having people who are too much burden. I think probably what we can look is that period can be shortened to something that we can be, say, fairly reasonable. So that it does not mean that we are opening up a system for exploitation.
Yeah.
And if someone's period of, someone's wants to actually not to serve the minimum period after the extinguishing, there should be another kind of a process to say my circumstances have changed and so forth. But I don't know, because it will introduce something new.
Yeah.
Something to say, if I've extinguished and then I want to come back before that cooling off period is, before it lapses, then now I want to be reconsidered. It's another issue, and I don't want to introduce it now because it will introduce further delays. But the idea in the main is to say 4 years is a longer period. The other days that are being tried to juxtapose them, therefore a different context, the advocate is correct. If you've paid, you've just paid. The issue is that the system must just be able just to take out the flaking out. But this one is clear, someone was given a relief. That extinguishing is about the relief. But if you are under, you have just gone through that, let's just have a proposal. In the main, what's coming out, 6 months. I will not want to put my head on that one, because I know the other proponents in the equation, they'll say, no, but why are you reducing it so much?
Yeah.
It's going to be a debatable figure, but there should be intentions to bring it down.
All right, Honourable Khadebe, and then I saw
several hands coming up. Let me take them in order. I did see Honourable Williams, but I'd like him as chair of the subcommittee to come last. So I'm going to take the Honourable Kecharia, the Honourable Elvis, the Honourable Mantash, the Honourable Williams.
No, Chairperson, I think that in the spirit of ensuring that even our citizens or our consumers have responsibilities, you know, the rights come with responsibilities.
Yeah.
But the issue of reducing this thing, because already 4 years, the person will have gone through the 4 year period plus training. So the issue of 6 months, I'll support it, Chair.
Then we go to the bottom there, the Honourable Elvis.
Thank you, Chairperson. I want to go back to the legal advice that we received regarding the tribunal, and that we should not take away the discretion of the tribunal. It would be unconstitutional. And I would like to say then, in light of that, that the clause that states 12 months and may be extended for further 12 months provides a discretion to the tribunal. So it says 12 months, but if the circumstances warrant in their discretion, they can extend it then for up to another further 12 months. So it can be another 6 months or 3 months, whatever they deem necessary in the circumstances, and I would support that position. Thank you.
Honourable Kecharia.
Thank you, Chair. I think clearly we need a cooling off period of some sort. Now we're trying to determine, you know, what is the optimum period. If after a suitable cooling off period a person then wants to enter the debt market, as it were, again, it's on their record, as it were, that they've applied for debt relief or debt extinguishment. So a responsible credit provider will take that into consideration, and there has been a cooling off period, which I think is sufficient. But the problem arises with irresponsible and reckless debt credit providers. How are we dealing with that? Because we're putting all the measures in place for the responsible people to react responsibly, we're putting cooling off periods for it, but the reckless credit providers need to be dealt with, because that's the issue. And if we don't do that, then we're just messing around, really.
Tash?
I would align myself to what Honourable Khadebe has said, because I can't differ with my whip. Although, let me not go there.
Yeah. Else? Honourable Mantash, do you want to add anything?
But support Honourable Khadebe.
Yeah, that's it, right. Now we have listened to everyone except the Honourable Williams. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I think that some of the issues were raised are covered. You can buy your way back into if your debt's been extinguished and you're sitting in that 6 month period and you suddenly win the lotto, you can buy your way back again out of that situation. There is a clause like that. So we have, it's not a new clause, it's been discussed quite vigorously in the subcommittee. But I think that we should go for the 6 months and then give discretion to the tribunal for an additional up to 12 months. I don't think we should go for 24. So we should go from 6 to 12 months. The extra 6 would be in the discretion of the tribunal. And I think that's enough, considering that it's 50,000 rands. We're not writing off Adrian Williams' 250 million rand debt. We're writing off somebody's 50,000 rand debt. So I do think we shouldn't penalize them. And hopefully, if we can give the good training and we can capacitate our people not to get in these circumstances again, then that will be what we're trying to do here. We're not, you know, it's all about capacitating us, our population, so that we don't find ourselves over-indebted in the future. So I would propose that. Thank you.
Thank you. So we've had a lot of discussion in previous weeks exactly on this situation as well. But I'm glad we're threshing it out, because
you've added a new dimension there, Honourable Williams. Initially we were talking about 12 months and then the discretion and then the 24 months and further. But you have now, and I'm not sure if that was your intention, because as I saw it, the initial intention is to say it's 12 months is just too long. Let's shorten that. Yes, and generally most people, members could be persuaded. But then to take, to put a lid on the 24 months would be to put a lid on the discretion of the tribunal. So, you know, I think you can't have it both ways, you see. And this is my concern. I'm looking towards experts on my left here that we could go. I will take you, Honourable Yesterhausen, the 6 months or whatever, but then let it be the discretion of the tribunal after that. So a minimum of X, but that. Honourable Yesterhausen.
Madam Chair, in principle, I agree with everyone, all the members have said. I'm not... I think even a two-month rest period after the time would be for the responsible consumers. The problem is, like Advocate Albert said, there's no... Advocate Van Amerven said there's no consequences for the consumer. Madam Chair, nothing in the world is for free. Our courts are already backlogs of inadequate systems and things. And the longer we make it, or the shorter we make it, we, like one of the members mentioned, this will force people to go to the money lenders and things like that. So I really think that we must consider a longer period, although I agree that for the responsible consumers, even a rest period of 2 months would be adequate. Because they need a credit, and this is what this bill is going to... What we don't know, Madam Chair, is we don't know what the impact is going to be, the financial impact of this study. We actually need to do a financial economical impact study after this has been done on this whole bill. Because we don't know, really. The financial institutions is the ones that really going to make it much, much more difficult for everyone who's lending money. That's the point
Thank you, Honourable Yesterhausen. Just to perhaps remind you, you may not have been there just at that time when the department indicates they will be doing this assessment afterwards. Check the impact, etc., etc. And indeed, that is welcome. But what was referred to in this discussion was by some members was this maximum exclusion. Some referred to it as 4 years. I'm reminded here by Ms. Sheldon that it's 3 years, actually. 3 years. Is that right, Advocate Van der Merwe? Maximum exclusion of 3 years with proposal, which is the current proposal, from the first suspension order. Is that correct?
Chair, the exclusion is up until the actual extinguishing would then be a period of, well, your application period, and then from the suspension would be 1 year for the first suspension, extension of the second suspension for another year, so that's 2 years, plus your application period, and then extinguishing happens in that third year. So it will be a three-year period plus your application period.
Look, I think my understanding of what members are saying, and there appears to be convergence here, is that 6 months. I'm looking at all of you now. But that where there may not be total convergence, but I'm hoping to persuade you all, is that we leave it to the discretion of the tribunal and not, say, the maximum of 12 months, as it were, but rather should the tribunal feel 2 years or whatever, that could be allowed. That would allow us to get through most constitutional hurdles, I believe, because you're putting the criteria there. Honourable Williams?
Surely, Chairperson, if we give the tribunal 3 months' discretion, we would go through the constitutional hurdle. It doesn't matter the length of the time of the discretion. And that is why I'm arguing not 24 months, but rather 12 months. Thank you.
I hear you. I don't see any hands flying up on that one at all.
And we have had 24 months for some time now. You see? And what we have changed is the initial thing of 6 months. So, Honorable Williams?
So I'm not sure, Chairperson. Is my 12-month suggestion being rejected? I just want some clarity, that's all. The reason I'm saying is the argument that was put here was that the tribunal needs to have some discretion or else it's going to be unconstitutional. But then the number of 24 months, the number actually doesn't matter how long the discretion is, because as long as there is discretion. I'm just saying that 6 months after the debt has been, you know, they've gone through the process and received the write-off or, you know, extinguishing, then the tribunal can come in for another 12 months maximum to make discretion. So it could be an 18-month suspension of credit, that sort of thing.
I think you are heard. I'm going to take the final two hands, and then we do need to move. Let me hear what has been said here first. Yes, Honourable McLaughlin. Honourable Pecharia, Honourable Khadebe.
No, thanks, Chair. I think Comrade Honourable Williams is not that he's not being supported. We are saying that we are trying to find a tricky balance. Firstly, the issue of coming to a minimum of 6 months as a principle to say cooling period has to be there, so that we demonstrate that we are serious, that all parties have to be responsible in the act. That's one. At least the 6 months is there. We are saying we have an institution that we say on these matters is best place, which is the tribunal. And we agree with you that the discretion of not exceeding 12 months should be supported, Chair. Our silence was meaning consent. But now we have triggered us to speak. Thank you.
Mine's a question, Chair. From the date of the application of the person for relief or intervention or whatever you want to call it, to extinguishing, during that period, it's my understanding that the person would not be able to
yes,
and that is how long?
Well, that's what we've said.
3 years. And then now we're talking about another 12 months or another 6 months, yeah. on top of that. Yeah, I mean, I think that balance, 6 of 1 and half a dozen of another, we've just got to take the correct, send the message out about moral hazard here. And I think the cumulative number of periods is sufficient.
Honourable Kachari, I like your expression of the cumulative. Honourable Khadebe?
Chairperson, I'll just concur with my colleagues, who are in particular in the study group, that 6 months is the minimum cooling period. The extension which can be done is another 6 months, which can go to 12, and then that's it. Because now it translates to 4 years, basically.
What I want to know, I think the principal has agreed to, I just want the advocate, Van der Merwe, to look at how it's been worded at the moment, where it talks about may not exceed 24 months, where you cap that. You actually, it's not, I don't think members took that wording into account. We all agreed, yes, if you want to, you can extend it by another 6, by another 12. But at this point, there was a cap here. Right, Honourable Van der Merwe.
Thank you, Chair. What we'll do in subsection 8 is for a minimum period of 6 months, so that's where the 6 will come in. Subsection 9 will then change to say, apply for credit contemplated in subsection 8, paragraph A, may not exceed 12 months.
Right. Now, we're not going to be re-debating this point, members, even if another member joins us who is an honourable member of this group. It's closed. What we will do is when we finally vote on it at the end, clause, you know, then yes, it can be raised. I hope I'm clear. Right. Advocate van der Merwe.
Thank you, Chair. I'm then paging over to page 22. Subsection 10 there just deals with the notification of orders. Subsection 11 is where there was false information supplied to the tribunal that the order may be rescinded. The deletion there of subsection 12, it's just that I've taken that and I've moved it to section 86A. So that it's an actual referral that is limited and not the actual order. The next clause, clause 16, just deals with the effect of debt intervention and with rehabilitation. On the effect of intervention, nothing has changed from draft 5. So there can be no further credit application. The credit provider cannot enter into any litigation. And if they do, that would be invalid. So that goes over to page 24. So I have gone a bit fast through that one, but like I say, it comes from draft 5 and nothing has changed to it. So an application for rehabilitation is then 88B. And I've just made a note that there was another clause in there, but we have made provision for that elsewhere. So this is just because we messed with the part. That's just why the comment is there. 88B, sorry, if I, there were clauses in draft 5 in between the effect and the rehabilitation, where if there's a circumstances that change, then the consumer must come. I've taken that out because we have provided for it elsewhere. So if I can then go to the application for rehabilitation, again, not much has changed. So if the debt intervention applicant has proof that they have repaid the cost of credit on the date of the order, so I'm now on page 24, section 88B that's being inserted, then, and what we have here is that the cost of the credit on the date of the order, if that is repaid, then there can be this application for rehabilitation. The minister may prescribe what else may be necessary. The reason for that was just to remove the operational issues that were in the section initially. And there must also be some proof that the applicant has actually done the program. Then how it works, subsection 4, going over on page 25, the National Credit Regulator must notify everyone, must consider it, and refer it to the tribunal. Then subsection 5, if the credit regulator rejects the application, there is some relief. The debt intervention applicant can approach the tribunal directly. Subsection 6, tribunal must notify the credit providers when they will consider this application. And 7, they must consider it. And if they think that they have complied, they may order rehabilitation. Subsection 8 simply says, this order has the effect that any limitation on the rights of the debt intervention applicant contemplated in Section 60 is ended from the date of the order. So in other words, any limitation on your right to apply for credit is stopped on that order. From there on, there will be no limitation. Then Subsection 9 just says that the regulator must notify the relevant parties of that order. Then over on page 26, clause 17, this is just a consequential amendment. So I don't know, it comes from the previous draft. It deals simply with Section 89, simply deals with unlawful credit agreements, and it is tied very closely with the next clause, clause 18, which amends Section 90, which deals with unlawful provisions of credit agreements. All that this does is it empowers the tribunal to also make orders in respect of unlawful credit agreements. So I'm not going to go too long into that, because it is very much consequential. The next one, 19, this is the credit life insurance that is compulsory. So section 106. What we have corrected here is actually on page 27, the main paragraph there, subsection 1A that we're inserting. First off, we have indicated that the 6 months may have to be amended, so we have provided for it to be prescribed a different time period. The same with the 50,000, a different period to be prescribed. Simply because this is something that is long-term,
we might look 5-10 years down the line, and then this is no longer a relevant period or amount. And then, of course, we made it very clear that it is not a credit provider that must enter into the life insurance. Credit provider must require that the consumer enters into it. So it could be that the credit provider has a product, or that it is another insurance company that has that product. The remainder of the amendments are very much just consequential, except on page 28, not that it is new. On page 28 there, we've just made it very clear that the limit in respect of the cost of credit life insurance, this compulsory, must be determined by the Minister in consultation with the Minister of Finance. And the reason for the in consultation is because we're affecting insurers who fall under the Minister of Finance. So there must be agreement here that we don't have unintended consequences in the insurance industry. The next clause, clause 20, is also a consequential amendment. It amends section 129 of the Act, which deals with required procedures before debt enforcement. So it is just to make sure that you also have debt intervention being considered before you go for any litigation. And then all of it is consequential. At the bottom there of page 28, it is where...
One moment, please. Yes, you were talking about the credit insurance. Right, okay. And now I heard you talking about insurance, and for a moment I thought we were talking about the levy. Do proceed.
Thank you, Chair. So at the bottom of page 28, that is also just a consequential amendment, because just to make it clear, because the tribunal can extinguish a portion of the total cost. So just to say, it only applies to that portion. It actually speaks for itself, but the public has indicated, no, you need to make it clear that it only applies to that portion that is extinguished. On the next page, page 29, we are now at clause 21. Again, this is a consequential amendment. It deals with debt procedures in a court. So it simply indicates that where this credit agreement, the debt under it, the cost of credit under that agreement was again extinguished, the court cannot consider the matter because it is extinguished. So clause 22, again, consequential amendment, 137, section 137, which deals with initiating applications to the tribunal. So in other words, it just makes it clear that debt intervention applications can go to the tribunal, and they have the power to actually consider those applications. The next clause, clause 23, deals with section 142 of the Act, which deals with hearings before the tribunal. Again, simply consequential, making it clear that the tribunal can hear these applications. Because just maybe if members wondering why all these consequential amendments, the tribunal and the regulator are creatures of statute, so we need to spell out their powers. The next clause, clause 24, deals with section 152 of the Act, and again it is a consequential. It deals with status and enforcement orders. This is something that was in draft 5. It is simply that we don't provide that the orders of the tribunal actually applies to a credit provider or a consumer. And I think it was just an oversight in the Act from the start. So that is just to correct that. The next clause, this is now again, it's not a flag issue, but it is something that is more substantial. This is where we create offences. So the first, 157A, deals with offences where a person applies for the debt intervention, but they give false information, or they present the information in such a way that misleads the regulator or the tribunal, or they intentionally alters their financial circumstances in order to qualify, and that would be an offence. In other words, this is to say, don't come and make abuse this debt intervention. It is really there for people who qualify. Then 157B
relates to all the prohibited practices. So before, this was just subject to an administrative order. Now we say, if you participate in any of these, then that constitutes an offence. So I'm not going to go through them. It's just the prohibited conduct throughout the bill, throughout the Act. Subsection 2, over on page 31, this is where it deals with prescription. So if you participate and you sell a debt that has actually been extinguished by prescription, then you're guilty of an offence. Or if you try to collect on that debt, you're guilty of an offence. The next, 157C, this is the offences related to registration. I think this is the most important offences that the bill creates. So if you're not registered as a credit provider of development of credit, a credit bureau, debt counsellor, payment distribution agent, or an alternative dispute resolution agent, then you are guilty of an offence if you practice as if you are registered. But we did make a defence possible there. So first off, if you were busy applying for your registration, then you won't be guilty of an offence. This is over on page 32. And the last one there, paragraph C, if the act is a once-off transaction, or it is a transaction that is incidental to your main business, then as long as your main business is not the provision of credit or debt counselling or payment distribution, etc., then you will not be guilty of an offence. And the reason for that is that it was pointed out by the public that an attorney might, for instance, where you purchase a house, you have to pay a certain guarantee to the sectional title, the management agent, or to the council for the rates and taxes, and that might be a big amount. It might be something like 6,000 or 12,000 or 13,000, depending on your, and not everyone has that amount immediately. Then the attorney says, look, if you pay that amount to me in cash, then I just pay it over to the council for you, but if you want me to pay that for you, then you will pay me instead of the 6,000. When you get your money out in the end, you'll have to pay, you'll pay me 9,000. But that then constitutes an incidental credit agreement. And so you don't want an attorney to be caught up in the argument, but are you actually providing credit, etc. So that is just what that is provisioned for. William?
Thank you, Chairperson. Does this clause then mean that loan sharks are now being made criminal? I just want to know, is that what's happening here with this clause? Because previous to this, it's not criminal. I'm just getting clarity, Chair.
Right, Honourable Kacharia.
Sorry, Chair, advocate is understandably going a bit quickly, but I just want to take us back to the issue of a question I have around the insurance, that was, I think it was on page 32, insurance requirement. I think we need to apply our minds to who would sanction the parameters of the insurance offering and the training offering, because who gets to choose? Is it the applicant, the credit provider, or the tribunal? Because this opens the door to potential misuse, and we need to be clear on that.
I don't think it was page 32.
Sorry, I can't remember
that. 27. 27, yes. All right, Honourable
Esterhazy. Madam Chair, thank you. And I don't want to sound negative. On page 28, 20C, I'm still concerned about the financial impact of this, the extinguishing of the thing. We've got about 16 million people that qualify for debt intervention, and we are on the 7,550,000. 1650 is 80. What is that? 800 million? No, 800 billion rand. So half of that, that's 400 billion rand. If this is, I'm concerned about the financial impact of this whole thing.
You're actually raising this question around 21, are you? I'm just trying to get that page 28.
It's more than the whole parliament budget.
Or are you raising it generally? Honourable Esterhazy? Which specific clause were you referring to? Because you said page 28.
20C, where the tribunal decide on the when the debt is extinguished. You know, if an applicant's financial circumstance does not improve, the tribunal can declare the debt under the qualifying credit agreement extinguished. That is as it now stands, isn't it? And that's what worries me, the financial situation and the consequences that's going to come up. And that's why I mentioned these figures. That's more than the whole parliament's budget, what we're speaking of here. And it could have dire consequences.
All right, here we are. That's on the table as well. Are there any comments? We have the one from the Honourable Kacharia here, which was referring to the insurance, if I'm not mistaken. Am I correct?
And training.
And training. And then the other point from Honourable Kacharia. Honourable Williams? I mean, not Honourable Kacharia, Honourable Eersterhuizen. Honourable Williams?
Sorry, Chair, I just wanted to talk to the Honourable Eersterhuizen's question. Am I allowed to do that? With regard to this, when we came with this subcommittee, this was one of the biggest questions we had, how much money this was actually going to cost South Africa. Fundamentally, we had these huge numbers, like 16 million people could qualify, and you know, and we looked at it very intensely. It's not like this has just gone across this table for the first time today. There's been some very intense discussions about what is the impact of this, and included in that was our trip to the United Kingdom, where we asked them questions about moral hazard, about unforeseen consequences of their debt review mechanism. And although they are a completely different country to us, and their people live in completely different circumstances to us, we could have some similarities between their poorest of the poor and our poor people. And they said that there was no moral hazard and that there wasn't any unforeseen consequences to their debt relief measures. But we have looked at it, and we also, during the work of the subcommittee, talked to the debt that's already been written off by those financial service providers. As we sit, they already write off massive amounts of debt. So I do think, although this appears to be this massive amount of money that's going to be written off, we have put in clauses to not make it so that you just apply today and tomorrow you get your money written off. It's going to take years and years, and we've tried to cushion the blow to the financial service providers. But we must bear in mind that our population is over-indebted, and it is over-indebted because of the ongoing lending by the credit providers. Even though they might not call it reckless lending, our population is massively over-indebted, so there must have been some irresponsible lending happening. And we have tried to compensate, or to not compensate, we've tried to cushion the blow that will occur. But it is in the best interest of South Africa if we can try to write off or extinguish the debt that is actually bringing our population to its knees. Thank you, Chairperson.
Yes, well, that has been our ongoing position, Honourable Eersterhuizen, in all of the meetings that have taken place. I know you haven't always been able to attend them, but let me allow you your final comments before we deal with the Honourable Kacharia's issue. All right, I'll...
Chair, thank you. I couldn't actually say anything about what happened in England. I wasn't even aware of the trip that was taken to England. So I can't comment on that. But I can't agree. I think it's total different circumstances what we have in South Africa and what in England. But I'm still saying that the financial implications is going to be really dire. And I think there's already banks have already voluntary measures built in. But I think Advocate Fanamera is doing an excellent job, and I agree with most everything basically what's said here. But I'm just saying a few concerns that I think that could make it even more difficult for lenders and things in the future.
Every comment is welcome. It adds to our understanding. So I just wanted to check, DDG, were you addressing this issue or Honourable Kacharia? All right, you do raise your point.
Thank you so much, Chair. What I wanted to say is that although research that was presented to the House
spoke about 9 million consumers. When we looked at the criteria of the amounts and then the salary, that the income that must be earned and the debt itself, and then we looked at the payment trends now from 6 to 9 months and the ability to pay by most of these consumers, we are looking at an estimated 1.5 million, not 9 million. So I wanted to just clarify to say that it's not as astronomical, as huge as the, if you look at 9 million and 1.5 million, there is a difference. So we did take this into account, just to add to what Mr. Williams just said now. Thank you.
All right. That again just gives us the information which we had before, but it's useful to hear it again. Yes. We come to your issue, Honourable Kachali. Are you speaking about the insurance? Honourable Williams, was this also on the same issue of Honourable Esterhazen?
Sorry, Chair. I did ask the original question that is actually about 32. I don't want that to be forgotten, whether or not this is going to criminalise...
We're taken back somewhat, I'm sure you appreciate. I don't want anyone left behind. Honourable Kacharya just mentioned that again. You're talking about insurance, am I correct?
We're stipulating that insurance is required, as we stipulate that training is required.
Yes.
Now, then that raises the question as to how the providers of insurance and training are determined, what the content is and how, and what the providers of that content are, how are they governed, how are they appointed, who appoints them, who has the choice to appoint them, because all these things are opens the door to lots of shenanigans potentially.
Well, with respect to the cost of credit insurance, I think that was pretty clear. It was going to be the Minister in consultation with the Minister of Finance prescribing. We had a lot of discussion over that when it came up, and that was seen as, well, the two together, you would come out with something reasonable. With respect to the other one, in which you're speaking about the training, etc., and who should be doing it, at the time that came up, you may recall, the issue of even other institutions providing it was referred to, and also the timing and when and how. But I think you are looking at probably capacity rather than anything else. Could you clarify?
No, Chair. I think you got me wrong here. What I'm looking at is that someone is going to provide insurance, yeah, and someone is going to provide training. There are many people who are going to vie for this because it's a potentially lucrative opportunity that has been created by this bill. Now, that requires that ask the question of who is going to be responsible for granting the permission, under what circumstances, for X to provide the service, at what cost? Because if the tribunal has the right to do this, under what circumstances is that circumscribed? If the consumer has the right to choose, then that raises a number of, that's probably the freest issue. So that requires some clarification, and that's what I'm raising.
Well, I think it's two different issues, the insurance and the training. I don't think, they're the same thing, because I understood that the credit insurance, which was coming forward from the subcommittee, was considered compulsory. Do you want to explain that, please, Honourable Williams, before we get the advocate's intervention?
Chairperson, I think I understand Honourable Kachalia's question. We're creating huge opportunities for both training providers and for insurance companies. Now the question is, should the training provider become Williams Training and Insurance Company? Because, potentially that's what could happen here. So there should be some mechanism to stop it from this becoming a massive, a fraud. There should be some mechanism, but I think the mechanism could be through the regulations. We could put this through the regulations. or, well, it, you know, we, because of the price of insurance has been, we have been told what the minimum and maximum prices can be. Perhaps if the insurance industry then use those prices and come out with products, then perhaps for the insurance there should be choice. But, you know, but I'm just saying that that's what he was saying, and so that's what we're talking about now currently.
It's not the same as the training, although at one point it's linked.
It's just the opportunity for training. That's why perhaps we should give it to the CETAs to come out. I don't know, Chairperson.
Honourable Maslobo.
No, I think, Chairperson, the point being raised is a fundamental point, but it can't be definitive in the Act. It's issues of the mechanics and the risks that will come out during the implementation. And the department now, while we're actually processing this, because we're trying to close one risk, now we're opening another possibility. They will have to start to work on draft a regulation that within a particular short period, immediately this legislation come into account. We don't actually open up to certain scrupulous elements that can actually put people in dire circumstances, because also issues of insurance, they have very serious financial implications.
Thank you, Honourable Maslobo. I think, look, the issue has been raised. There are various measures that can be taken. The principle here is that we do want compulsory insurance, and I think members agreed on that. The challenge becomes we want to try and prevent abuse of having agreed to that. And members are saying, as I understand it, let us put that in regulation. I hope I'm looking at everyone. Can we then move to, I thought we were on page 29. But here's your issue, Honourable Williams. Said, you know, there's Honourable Williams' issue, page 32, yeah.
Thank you, Chief. If I may just maybe answer, on the insurance, there will be now a choice to the consumer to go to whichever insurer provides the best option for them. And those options will only be limited by the maximum cost of that credit. In respect of training, there will be specific institutions provided for in regulation, whether that is through the Treasury creation of training or whether the DTI will do their own training, but that will be through regulation. In respect of the question on...
Let's have, I think, advocate with your team, just look at this thing. In as much as you don't want to limit the choice of association or the ability to enter into contract, but the fees or the rates must be in such a way that it doesn't compound the situation. Remember what we're trying to do. We're dealing with the compounding the situation. You close one door, you open the other door in terms of the real applications, in terms of economics. I'm just flag that, because that's what is going to happen. But in the meantime, let's not go into details. But in the main, the issue of insurance as a principle has been agreed. The mechanics and how do you regulate that in terms of even how you actually get into, even if you choose. But the market itself, it doesn't actually determine certain things that become challengeable.
You know how many times that's failed, yes. Page 31. Well, mine is 31, I think. Weren't you referring to the offences? You've just had one comment there. Could you raise your issue again, Honourable Williams?
Thank you, Chair. My issue was, does this clause, I think it's 15... on page 31 and 32, does it criminalise machinistas? Thank you.
Because you will recall, Advocate, that at one point either you or the department or the NCR pointed out that where they were arrested or jailed or both was when they were in possession of IDs, but not for what we thought the actual offence of operating as an unregistered lender.
Yes, Jen. If we look at section 157C, subsection 1, paragraph A, so any person who intentionally gets him or herself out to be a credit provider, but who has not registered under Section 39 or Section 40, whichever is applicable, is guilty of an offence. So it definitely makes anyone who acts as an unregistered credit provider will be committing an offence. Yes. If I may then proceed, Chair, over on page 32,
Honourable Kichalia.
The definition of a machinisa, I mean, if I lend the advocate money, I'm not really registered lender, am I a machinisa?
Chair, we have provided for that because that was a concern. So on the top of page 32, paragraph C there, we say if the act in question is a once-off transaction or incidental to your main business, which business may not be the provision of credit, then it's not an offence. So it is a once-off transaction between you and
you and your family, or you know the workers and so on. Wait, Honourable Williams, I am recognising you, Honourable Maclauba, Honourable Williams.
You see, Comrade Williams is asking a funny one, because you know these things, they can look, you can look on a narrow scope, but lending between individuals, Honorable Kacha, it has landed many people in trouble in terms of combating and prevention of corrupt activities. But I think it should be, let me not go there, because it's a discussion another day. All the time you try to close something, something open up.
Yeah.
You know, those of us who are sitting here, another law calls us prominent, influential persons or individuals, peeps. And if I led this comrade, comrade chief whip, comrade Bumai, as long as it has no intention, but probably without delaying this one, advocate, let's look at it, because you have other legislations, and it depends who are these people who are actually doing some of this thing, because the veil of how sophisticated people are when it comes to corrupt activities or money laundering activities and others is a very thin line. Actually, to find it, you must have a very sharp nose. To look at it, but for responsible people, I think the definition here very suffice. But sometimes if you have a mind of a security guard, you always look at where can they go through.
You have got a point, the actual practical implication. Honourable Williams.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I think that the important part of this provision that takes away from personal lending and lending to your family and even lending, you know, anywhere, even you're borrowing money from your company. It says provided that the main business of the person may not be the provision of credit, debt, counseling, etc. So in other words then, if your main business is not lending money, you can lend money and you won't be in provision, you know. But if you're a loan shark, the mere fact your name even implies that you're lending money. So it does actually cover all of us who are going to lend me money at the end of this meeting. Thank you, Chairperson.
No, but these issues have come up repeatedly. I mean, in companies, especially in the construction field, companies lend their workers money and they call it advances, and then the worker doesn't get to really pay it back, it's just deducted from the wage, and actually that's illegal as well, unless there's documentation. So a lot of these things do happen, but informally, but I think we all know who we're getting at. Can we leave it at that point? Yes, and move. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. And then moving on to the new Section 157D, and all that this actually does is just that where the person who committed this offence is not a natural person, other than a company or a firm, etc., this simply says then they can also be found guilty, that company, etc., etc. The next clause, clause 26, deals with penalties. Just to take us back to that illegal fellow, I suppose it could be a woman. Now, the issue here, I wanted to ask, in the light of these offences,
we keep on talking, is this going to criminalise someone? Is it an admin? What is this here? We call them all offences, but what are we actually saying here?
Chair, this is an offence makes it a criminal, it's criminalised. So there's no longer an administrative fine applicable to this. It is now something that, if there is a fine, it is something that goes onto your record. It is not simply something that comes off your budget, like an administrative fine would be. So the person who committed it will have a record, and in respect of companies, I think there's also registration issues around that.
Honourable McLaughlin, is it about this?
Yeah, it's about this. I'm not sure whether at a particular point there is a thought for simplifying these things for implementation purposes, even for those that are affected directly or indirectly. There is a lot of offences that I think are coming out of this legislation. That, don't you think it might be advisable to have a schedule of offences at the end of this legislation? Other legislation where say these things as an offence, so, but it's not a decision to be made now. But I could see we don't jump more than 5 pages or 6 without something coming closer to an offence. Thank you, Chair.
No, I noticed that, and we should be mindful of that. When we've completed the our bill. Yes, Honourable Mantash?
I think, Chair, the community is becoming wiser every day because of the previous experiences. For instance, in the BBBEE, we had a nasty experience of people who do not comply with the legislation that we enacted as Parliament. And we are becoming wiser now. I would support this.
Thank you very much. I think that's a pertinent point to keep in mind for all legislation. Can we proceed, please, Honourable Advocate Vandermeerwe?
Thank you, Chair. Chair, just to confirm this clause inserts these sections into Part B in the Act, which deals with offences. So there is a specific part in the Act that deals with offences. They are all put together. If I can go into Section 161.
Advocate, don't lose the point. The point is to say this is a good legislation. And at the end, because there's a lot of reference, you know, when you put the schedule of offences at the back, they are so definitive. So definitive, even someone who becomes an adjudicator or an arbitrator, just go there at the back because it's part of the package. Let's not make a determination now, but I can tell you it's a very useful instrument.
Oh, I see. Yes. On the practical side of it as well, can we keep that in mind for as we finish the, gone through the bill itself, is what we want to do. There are 3 things we have kept in mind. This is the 3rd one. And I notice some folks are very quiet, and I hope you are getting as excited as we are and not falling asleep. Right, continue, Advocate Vandermeerwe.
Thank you, Chair. If I can then get to Clause 26, penalties. What we have, the only thing that we've changed here from Draft 5 is that a person who supplied false information or massaged their financial circumstances, that was a 10-year imprisonment. We've reduced that to 2 years, and the rest have remained exactly the same. So for prohibited conduct, or for unregistered transactions, that is all still 10 years or a fine. And where the person is not a natural person, so if it's a company, it is a fine not exceeding 10% of annual turnover or 1 million rand, whichever amount is the greater. And then in subsection 2 there, we are just saying when the courts look at an appropriate penalty, these are the factors they must take into account. And it is the same as the administrative fine, but it does give the courts a good guidance on what type of fine to impose. And then subsection 3 just talks about how you determine annual turnover, because you have to now calculate it for that fine. Then on the next page, clause 27, section 164, this is just a consequential amendment again. Section 164 deals with civil actions and jurisdiction. So it just also adds some powers to the tribunal in respect of unlawful provisions, so just consequential. Clause 28 deals with Section 165 of the Act, and this again is consequentially deals with variation of orders. So just to say when the tribunal may change or rescind an order. So if there is information before the tribunal to show a person was dishonest, or if a person fails to comply with the conditions of the order or fails to comply with the Act. So that just gives the tribunal some powers that they will need in order to execute what we have put in. The next section, the next clause 29, this is a flagged issue dealing with the regulations. The first part, I think, is important. Paragraph A deals with the levy. So what we have there is that the minister must make regulations regarding participation in a financial literacy or financial capability program. That's the first part. So the reason it is set a little bit vague is to allow for the minister to make regulations that indicate participation will be in the National Treasury program, or if that is not set up in time, the minister may make regulations regarding participation in a program that DTI has set up. So it gives the minister room to move on where these programs will be and what they will look like. The second part, the blue part, then deals with the levy. If I can just point out to members, or just refresh members' memory, a levy itself constitutes a money bill. So it's not something that this committee can do. We cannot put it in our bill. It will have to be through the Minister of Finance. So that is more a political and behind-the-scenes action that will have to happen. But the committee said that we would like some referral to this. So what I have here, I've put in with this financial literacy and capability program to say that the minister must consult the minister responsible for finance on the funding of such a program. So in other words, there will be some consultation, and however that is done, we're not prescribing that it must be a levy, but that is the intention behind that clause. So that is maybe just the first flag issue, the levy issue.
Just clarify, is that D? D then on page 35, before prescribing a debt intervention, the measure contemplated in paragraph A, the minister must consult.
No, Chair, right at the top of the page, paragraph B, capital A, must make regulations regarding participation in a financial literacy or financial capability program and must consult the minister responsible for finance on the funding of such program.
Sorry, it's the bottom of my other page. Right, okay. And that was the issue around the levy that was raised in London. Honourable Williams?
Chairperson, I'm a bit concerned by this clause because it doesn't seem to put the emphasis on the levy. It just says that the minister must consult the other minister and look into ways to fund the program. So it doesn't talk to a levy at all. In fact, it doesn't even say who would pay that levy if there were a levy. So, for instance, the Minister of Finance could do something different, not related, and to finance this. So I'm a bit concerned. Is there no way that we can lock this down more? What happens if the Minister of Finance says, no, we can't pay for the program, and then basically what happens is the fact that we need to pay for this this financial literacy program, which we've made compulsory, and if there's no money for it, then the whole thing just falls apart right there at this clause. So I'm a little bit concerned about this. Is there no way we can put more muscle behind this clause and somehow, because it seems that we're basically stuck now. If the Minister of Finance rejects this, then that's it. The legislation won't get implemented.
Well, I was going to propose and seeking your legal advice here, Advocate. Why can't we mention the term levy? We're not actually developing it. But, this is one way that we want, a measure we want to consider, and that in order to achieve certain ends, and that the Minister of Trade and Industry would have to consult the Minister of Finance to to actually put such a law through or something? Because we can't, we know that. But can't we actually be very specific here and refer to it?
Jay, can I maybe ask, I'll go and have a look at that. It is a very, very, very thin line that we're walking here. But I'll go and have a look and see if there is something where we can maybe use some example from another bill that wasn't classified as 77, and see if from there we can take something and maybe use the word at least.
Because remember, members, we also don't want to change classifications of the bill, etc. Before you come in, Honourable Williams, can we, Dr. Masocha just wanted to intervene there as well to assist.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Advocate. On the issue of the levy, without going into the legalities, depending on how it's phrased, it might affect the bill to an effect that it might have to be turned into a money bill. But you'll have to look into that. But in terms of this specific provision, Chair, the way it's written, it talks to the issue of training. I understand the UK lessons that came from this, but we do have a literacy and training component of this bill itself, and I wouldn't want this to be confused with the one where the credit providers are actually funding for this training, because in any case, we would provide for that through the normal funding process of National Treasury. So I don't think that if we are talking about that other training, we need to actually phrase it in this manner. But if it's about the levy and the other process, then we need to rework around this.
I do want to persuade all of the colleagues on this committee, we certainly do not want to turn this into a money bill. So we should be wary of that before going in. But notwithstanding that, we want to be as clear as we can be as to what measure we may have thought was suitable. Honourable Williams?
Chairperson, I don't think there's anything wrong with expecting the financial service providers to be paying for this financial literacy program. I don't think that we should move away from that. I think we should stay with inside this not becoming a money spill, but somehow try to put emphasis that the reason why we're over-indebted in this country is because the financial service providers have been lending to our people willy-nilly. And this is why. I mean, you can't say it's only the fault in. For instance, I'll give you an example. In the United Kingdom, the banking sector stepped up to the plate and said, it is some of our responsibility that our country was over-indebted. And I think if the banking service in the United Kingdom can say that, then I think our service financial service providers must also accept some responsibility for the situation that we're facing. So for them to pay for the financial literacy, I don't think is such a far-fetched thing. I could understand that they didn't want to pay for training about something else, but for financial literacy, I think it's not too much to ask them. And I think we should come up with some mechanism to persuade them to do so. Thank you.
I wish we could go that route. Honourable Khadebe?
Honourable Chairperson, I think last week we dealt with this thing for quite a long time. It was one of the sticking points which we had. I think the way it is now couched, I think it is proper, because it has removed us from a money bill to an ordinary 76 or 75 bill. So I think that let's live with that, knowing that the issue of funding of such program, it already indicates that there must be some money which must be raised to do that. As to how the Minister of Finance will determine that, it is his discretion. But as we were very afraid before that, we don't want any constitutional challenges to this bill. Because if we avoid that, the sooner it is going to be implemented. You can live with that, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Khadebe. I'll just take your point there, Honourable Ms. Matsugari.
I stand to be corrected, but I assume we could incorporate this within registration fees that are paid by credit providers on an annual basis. That might be challenged, but I think it's one way of incorporating the training portion within the registration fees that registrants pay, because credit providers pay registration fees every year. And normally what we would do is that we would make a proposal to the DTI to publish regulations around that, which would give an opportunity to credit providers to make submissions to the DTI. Thank you, Chair.
Right. I know that we do that, and then it's not classified as a money bill. Advocate van der Merwe, why isn't the registration fee classified as a money bill issue?
Chair, because it is seen as an administrative fee and not as a levy. The Constitution indicates anything that is a levy or a tax or something like that. So it is a bit of a technicality. It is still a very thin line.
Well, look, I think it's worth considering that creative or innovative line, but we don't want to cross the line into a money bill. Honourable Ms. Lawball?
I think, Chairperson, like Honourable Hadebe was saying, it's very important to say some of the things you don't become prescriptive. The intention is that financial illiteracy is a problem. Then the mechanics of how the funding is going to be sorted out. Then the two ministries are going to work out the mechanism. But we think financial literacy and in terms of the best practice, something is being done. Therefore, it's broad enough, the manner it is being broad, but also very cautious enough so that you don't do the over-creeping into other forms of bills that will necessarily put us into another process that we don't intend to and cause more delays, because the sooner we actually deal with the fundamental issues but at the very same time the sticky issues, then the relief intervention should have came in like yesterday to our people. I think we can be able to live with what is currently being put in here, but with a clear understanding that the issues of the funding mechanism and the modalities that it has to take, therefore the executive should be able to actually work on those. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Ms. Lawball. I think, look, we're all together here. Honourable Williams, I'm looking at you, all of us, I think. We're not going to use the word levy any longer. Let's refrain from that. We all know what we mean. All right. Is that the fascist salute, or is it telling me to move ahead?
Thank you, Chair. I find offence to that comment of yours. Chairperson, sorry, Chair. I also want to know. For instance, we're doing debt review mechanism is being done on the recipient, the people that benefit from this legislation, and to pay for that debt review, we have to pay for that as well. So, although you say we're not going to use the word levy, you know, who's paying for that debt review mechanism that we're supposed to be putting in place?
Well, I think the department has already indicated that it has certain funding that will do this, but that it also has the capacity to raise its registration fee. I really am asking members to refrain from the use of that word any longer.
Apart from that, that sign, I don't know whether it was learned over the last few days from his excellency, my comrade there, with the Chinese characteristics. We have said that we have requested also, just as part of completeness, producing something that is implementable. We have also requested Comrade Williams that at a particular point, they will actually have to look at a phased approach of the implementation, both the capacity, human resources, budget, systems, and others. That's what we have requested them to do. I think the question you are asking is an important question. Don't put it there, and you don't have the capacity to implement. But at the very same time, it has to be put there, and someone must be able to make resources, because hundreds and hundreds of thousands of our people are going to be the beneficiaries, but we'll also have the system changing much better in terms of people.
All right. Now I can see we're moving forward now. So again, that gave you a little respite, opportunity to have some water, but there we are. Advocate van der Merwe.
The next clause, or not a clause, but paragraph B within there, this is where we're talking about the prescribed measure. And the problem that we have with the prescribed measure was the constitutional concerns. Like I said to the committee, I don't think that there isn't sufficient guidance given to the minister on what to do and how to do it. But we have also given a definition for significant exogenous shock, and then I've also looked at the Disaster Management Act, and I have aligned our natural disaster with that act. So instead of calling it a regional natural disaster, I've changed it to provincial or national, which is the wording used by the Disaster Management Act. I just want to page to the next page so that I talk about the same thing at the same time. Sorry, not the next page. Page 37. At the bottom of, on the same issue, on the bottom of page 37, and then over on page 38, the definition of provincial or national natural disaster, where I'm referring specifically to the Disaster Management Act, and I then require that it must be declared as such in terms of that act. So in other words, I think we are making it very clear, if it is a disaster declared, that is then when the regulations can be made. And then the same for significant exogenous shock, which is the unexpected or unpredictable event affecting the economy nationally, and it must affect it negatively. So I think that we have sufficient description for it there, and I think at this point in time it becomes a policy decision whether it should remain or not. If I can go back to page 35, just to talk to the changes I've made on paragraph B, the changes there is simply that I've included joint estate. So because I've included joint estate, I had to make everything singular. So it's just a drafting thing that I've done there, but I've put it in blue so that it's clear what I've done. So Chair, I think I'm not going to go through the regulation itself because I think that was part of draft 5, and nothing else has changed except that.
Thank you, Chair. Mine, Chairperson, will be on amendment of section, this is 171, it's page 35, no?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's 20, I'm on 29B.
Yeah.
I was just checking this in session.
Uh-huh.
Around the question of the minister there, the, on B, Roman figure 1,
yeah,
to say constitutes a significant exogenous shock and which cause widespread job losses. Do you want to keep narrowly, assuming that everybody who gets into this has a job, or it should also, it can either be job losses or income? That's the only issue that I needed as a sort of a clarity. You see, sometimes how we couch certain wording, they become excluding, because it's not everybody that is actually having a job that is actually we're intending to. At least they get the point, the Comrade Chair.
No, it could also be the unemployed. They don't have jobs either. So let us take it one step at a time, Honourable Williams.
Chairperson, I agree with the Honourable Member because of the fact that you can not be recognised in formal employment and still lose that income if there's a earthquake or whatever there might be. So I think absolutely we should include that slight amendment there. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you.
All right. So we could overcome this by saying constitutes a significant exogenous shock and end there. Of course, it did end there at one point in time, Advocate van der Merwe. I'm quite well aware of that. And then we asked you to do certain things. But in so many ways, Advocate, we sometimes learn from our mistakes, all right? So members, are we all here? I've just received information, and I'm going to go and talk to the chair outside here. We booked this room till 1 o'clock, and now I'm told that the tourism is out here, and they, because they want the room at 12:30. We may still complete this, so let us move slowly on this point. Do we agree we should just leave it at exogenous shock? Who's got Advocate Vandermeer?
Chair, we must just be cautious. The rationale for the significant exogenous shock is that there must be, it's not just the fact of an exogenous shock. Remember that we're talking about a debt intervention measure that must be prescribed. The reason for the debt intervention measure is not the significant exogenous shock. The reason for the debt intervention measure is the fact that people can't pay their debts. Why can't they pay their debts? So we can say widespread loss of income, which leads to a widespread loss of income. It does make it a little bit more vague, because the job losses here does not speak to the people who will qualify.
Oh, yeah.
This speaks to the incident under which the minister can prescribe.
Okay.
The person, the trigger. So the trigger can be the exogenous shock which caused widespread job losses, or the provincial and national disaster. If one of those two happened, then the measure in paragraph B may benefit an indigent person or a person or a joint estate with an income of less than 7,500 per month, or a person or a group of people who suffered an unforeseen loss of income in a sector identified by the minister as being subject to mass retrenchment. So in other words, the A deals with the trigger, B deals with the people who will qualify, and C deals with the type of measure. So I can change it to loss of income, but I think it might make it a bit vague.
Well,
and yeah.
I'm going to take two hands, and then we move, because we've got 15 minutes left. Honourable Mantash,
Honourable Khadebe.
Chair, I propose that we keep the initial version of the paragraph.
No, Chairperson, I think Honourable Mantash, although the issue which was raised by Honourable is valid, because someone who, the loss of income, let's say I become a pensioner next year, I don't come back, I'll have some steady income every month, but then these exogenous shocks can affect me. Sometimes income will have to be better, but I see that this indigent also has broadened it up wide enough to make it.
We have got something further on here, all right, which covers that. Honourable, sorry, Esterhazen?
Honourable Esterhazen? Sorry. Chair, I agree with all the clauses that we could find, but I was just thinking tongue in the cheek. Maori's youth, the ex-time of now, also qualify.
I didn't hear it.
No,
we don't want the sign-offs, etc. Okay, let's move on. Fair enough. Yes, four, fine. We're now moving, thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I'm not going to go through the rest of this paragraph A to A, because it was in draft 5, nothing else has changed. There is this consultation process, it must be brought to the committee, etc., etc. On page 37, subsection 2B. Now, this is the issue that deals with the increase in the maximum salary and the 50,000 total unsecured debt. So what I provided for them separately. So I say that the minister may, by notice in the Gazette, and after having considered the following factors, may adjust the amount in the definition section in respect of the maximum gross income of a debt intervention applicant. So the first thing is, what is the gross income required by a consumer to be economically viable client for a debt counsellor? In other words, what the committee considered as well. Secondly, what the costs are that are associated with administration and sequestration orders, and inflation. B, the minister may, again, adjust the amount of the qualifying total unsecured debt after considering the effect inflation may have had on that amount. Then C, before the minister makes this adjustment, the minister must table the adjusted figure in the National Assembly with the rationale for the adjustment and obtain the approval of the National Assembly in respect of that figure. So this is the this was the flag issue, so I'm just going to leave it there.
Right. We requested this, members. We now have it. Do continue, advocate.
Thank you, Chair. Then the bottom of page 37, top of page 38, we have dealt with, so I can skip that. The next clause is the substitution of the long title. All that we do is we're providing for debt intervention. Then there is a transitional provision. Now, the transitional provision is our retrospective provision, so clause 31. What I'm saying here is that any clause that deals with the debt intervention application, any credit agreement that was entered into before this Act comes into operation falls under that. It applies. So it's not just credit agreements going forward. These are going backwards. So that is on that one. And then the last is the short title and the commencement clause.
Advocate, I want you simply to list for us the four or five issues. You will recall our decision that we may need to inform all those who'd come to the public hearings that these other issues have come up, four or five of them. It's a two-week process. At the same time, we're going to hand this over to the constitutional expert for comment. So just list those for the benefit of everyone, advocate.
Chair, the first issue, the issue of the offence falls away now because we've said that we're not making that an offence. The second issue is the issue of funding of the measure. The fact of the increase of the 7,500. Sorry, I just want to quickly see where the other one is. Mine is not with me. Sorry, Jay, I'm just quickly pacing through. I didn't make a list beforehand of it. I actually just talked on it as I got there. The issue of the court determining the maximum interest. And I think that is it, Jay, just those three issues. That is on page 13. Clause 12, where we allow the court to also determine the maximum interest, which may be zero.
Yeah, members, you may recall at one stage I spoke about us having probably to work to come back on Thursday. Well, you have done so well. You've certainly applied your mind. You've certainly deliberated. You know, we've threshed this out. We have reached convergence on these issues. But there are a few issues that we ourselves have requested we would like constitutional advice on. And so this bill will then, as we've completed it per se, as it is, it'll go with the flagged issues to the constitutional expert, and we will also, through Mr. Hermans, inform those who attended the public hearing and whatever, they will be informed. And no later than 3 weeks, we'll have this back. Honourable Khadebe.
I
think so, but it's just Mr. Hermans has to tell us when the next meeting is.
Chairperson, on the proceedings of this meeting,
members,
I think we're left at a disadvantage because I think that last week we promised that the report of UK will have had it by today, so that when we're making this input, we're able to integrate that. Now it has reverted to the chairperson, Honorable Mandash and Honorable Williams. Where is the report?
In fact, the report should have been here, so I'd rather ask Mr. Hermans.
Chair, we're not yet done with the report, Chair. As we discussed this morning, we hopefully should have the report out to members by Friday.
No, I don't want to have the word hopefully in that sentence. I would like us to be able to distribute the Thursday afternoon or Friday morning electronically. Honourable Williams.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I'm instructing, as the chairperson of the subcommittee, that we will have the report on Thursday evening or Friday morning. Thank you very much.
Sorry, I missed your point. No, I know, I think that was a wise crack. Don't worry. Honourable McLaughlin.
Not that sense, Chair. This comrade from China. but on a serious note, Chair, I think we should commend you and the whole team that was doing this. Well, my little time here, because I think this is an important piece of work you've done today. And the amount of work the team has put through and the colleagues who are sitting here, I can tell you, and if the cleaning up and the other processes that you are saying that must happen, I can tell you it's the biggest milestone. And I hope there will be less hangers going ahead. But the quality looks so good. And when people have done well, and we should be able to say advocate and the team that was supporting, they've done so well. And one day I was complaining just in a minute or less about the method of work. I think this method of work is actually makes our match work much more easy. So that people don't think that we're a little bit difficult. The subcommittee threshing issues out and how certain issues are being put. Mm-hmm. But the guys and yourself, how you have driven, you deserve a pat on the back for a job well done. And especially the comrade from Beijing.
Shall we? I saw your hand, Honourable Mantash. I do have to close.
Chairperson, I will echo Honourable Mashobo's words, but I don't want us to undermine the support that we got from the Department of Trade and Industry. Because at some point we were at a bad footing. But since then, they have improved. I think we also need to extend a word of gratitude to them. Thank you.
Right, members, we're going to be thanking National Treasury, who is not here this morning, the National Credit Regulator, the Department of Trade and Industry, and all those who, as guests who come here, who assist us in one way or the other. But in particular, yourselves, Honourable Williams. We were teasing you a lot this morning, but really, personally, I want to thank you very much, and for you leading the team you had, you worked very hard and effectively, but that subcommittee has served its term, and as you know, it is now part of the broader committee, and I hope that all of the colleagues sitting here will be participating in the debate when it comes up, eventually in August, September. To all of you, to our new whip, who without, I wondered how we did without him before. Thank you, Honourable Khademe, and all of you. Yes. And before I forget, the National Consumer Tribunal. Thank you to my Executive Secretary, as well as other members of staff here. On Thursday, we're not meeting. On Friday, we're not meeting. On Wednesday, the 30th of May, the deliberations on the Copyright Amendment Bill. From now on, we are driving what? The CAB, the Copyright Amendment Bill. Thank you very much. The meeting is adjourned till Wednesday.
Okay. I was thinking about it. Okay, thank you.